13 days after the greatest natural disaster that hit Syria in more than 100 years. The special Zionist package of death killed 5 civilians and wounded 20 others after targeting a residential area in the capital, Damascus. Has any other nation in modern history endured so far what Syria has? Despite Syria overcoming most of the challenge of the global war directed by Zionists and Americans against it, especially the danger of dividing the people and the land, in came the illegal Caesar's Act to complement the global Zionist Western war on Syria in an attempt to accomplish what the war failed to achieve by overthrowing the Syrian state. This hindered the Syrian state's capabilities from dealing with the earthquake disaster and at some point crippled the government institutions, impeding them from reaching certain stricken areas devastated by the disaster. All the while, the U.S. has been actively depriving Syria of its oil resources and agricultural lands looted by the Americans, destroying the bulk of its economic assets. This crime, which brought Syria to this disastrous situation through sanctions, siege, war, and looting, is what exacerbated and multiplied the earthquake catastrophe, and even made the U.S. crime committed against it with intent and persistence more dangerous than the natural disaster that hit the war-torn country. Welcome to the Middle East Stream. I'm Marwa Osman. Can overcome the disaster of the earthquake with its own capabilities and the support of its friends. But it will certainly overcome it effectively and quickly, along with all its internal crises, when the crime committed against it under American leadership and Zionist incitement stops. The crime took various forms, beginning and ending with sanctions, passing through siege and looting, continued with strife and wars and attempts to disintegrate Syria and divide it. The crime is governed by the philosophy of American arrogance as a framework, and its compass is the interest of the Zionist entity as a final goal. To discuss this issue with us from Beirut is Dr. Jamal Wakim, author, academic, and managing editor of the Contemporary Arab Affairs Journal. Thank you very much for being with us, Dr. Wakim. Now, the lack of capabilities that was master of the scene inside Syria after the devastating earthquake results from a continuous international crime against Syria instigated by the Zionist entity and the U.S. regime, while just less than 2 weeks later, after the earthquake, we saw the Zionist entity dropping bombs on the heads of the Syrians sleeping in the comfort of their houses in Damascus just 3 days ago. Is there a real way out for Syria from this?
Too bad. I believe that Syria will keep suffering from this situation as long as the United States is trying to destabilize the country, trying to support some separatists in northeast Syria, mainly the Qasad Kurds, and in an attempt to redraw the whole geopolitical map of the region, including Lebanon, Syria, and Iraq, based on confessional and ethnic lines. So that's why I believe that the United States didn't care much about the earthquake that happened, but saw it as an opportunity to further weaken Syria, to further try to destroy it, because what has been done by the earthquake was been done by the United States over the past 13 years now, alongside the Zionist entity. So an added evidence is the latest Israeli strike against civilians, peaceful civilians in Damascus. I believe that too bad we don't have a way out so far.
Well, but the aim of the United States imposed sanctions on Syria is basically to subjugate the people, the regime and the state and the institutions of the state as well to the will of the U.S. foreign policy. And this has been the game since the beginning of the war in 2011. So far, this has failed. Will this devastating earthquake break the will of the Syrian people this time?
I don't believe so, because the Syrians have been resilient over the past 13 years. They have been supporting, the majority of them, of course, they have been supporting their government against the attempts to destabilize it, to destabilize the country and to divide it into various states and sub-states. So I believe that they will keep fighting, and they are benefiting from the support of their allies and some Arab brothers, including, for example, the support that came from Iran, Russia, Iraq, Algeria, Lebanon, and other Arab states. Not many Arab states abstentiated from giving support, but I'm talking about many Arab states that did actually send support to Syria. And Syria will benefit from this to further resist the U.S. attempts to weaken it and to bring the country to its knees.
Well, Dr. Joaquim, the most important impact of U.S. sanctions on Syria was depriving it of its oil resources and of the agricultural lands as well in the northeastern part of the country, which was stolen by the Americans by destroying the bulk of what economy Syria has left and transforming it into a country that was once self-sufficient into a country that is always dependent on others to in basic needs of food, medicine, supplies, oil. So this brings the question of direct resistance against the actual physical U.S. occupation inside Syria, especially in the eastern part of the Euphrates. Is Syria in a state that would allow it to pursue such a resistance against an occupation that's already there?
I believe that the Syrians are preparing themselves for such a development. However, for the time being, I don't believe that it's within the capability of the Syrian government to support an armed resistance against the American occupation in northeast Syria. The Syrian government is trying to appease the Kurdish separatists there in order to draw them into dialogue with the government, and this is a mean for them to contain the situation. That's why they are refraining from supporting armed struggle in northeast Syria. But eventually, if the Americans persist in their occupation of this region, if they persist in supporting the separatists in their aim to divide Syria, I believe that it's out of question for the Syrians not to launch a war of resistance against this occupation.
Well, but lastly, Dr. Joaquim, what the Western mainstream media is propagating on its platforms is that the U.S. has, in fact, effectively removed and lifted the sanctions of Syria for it to allow for aid to help. But you know, as much as I know, that this is not the case because the Syrian banking system is still not working. People cannot wire money to Syria to help their families and their friends. So what was that announcement about, and what will it take for the U.S. to actually ease those sanctions?
Well, the U.S. declared, made this declaration, which is a false declaration because it didn't get implemented on ground, but because they were forced to make this declaration because they were faced by a wave of indictment by the majority of the countries in the world and the majority of the people in the world. Because the American government saw itself embarrassed, and that's why it made such a vocal declaration void of any essence, actually. Because, as you mentioned, the banking system in Syria is still under sanctions. The Americans are still pressuring the separatist Kurds in northeast Syria not to allow aid to cross from the regions that they dominate into the government-dominated regions. There are other, sanctions that are still in place. So that's why I believe that what the Americans did was a PR move in order to avoid embarrassment, especially after this wave of indictment by the majority of the peoples around the world.
So in less than a minute, Dr. Joaquin, so do you think that the help that Syria got from the states that actually broke the Caesars Act within hours from the earthquake would be sufficient for it to try and at least reconstruct what the earthquake broke?
Too bad, despite the generous aid coming from friendly and brotherly countries to Syria, like Iran, Iraq, Russia, Lebanon,
Algeria.
Jordan, Algeria, etc. However, this aid is short of helping the government restructure the whole economy, especially that it's still passing through a state of war imposed on it by the United States and the Zionist entity. So this will be short of helping Syria achieve its aim in reconstructing the country. We need more aid, we need more lavish donations and bilateral cooperation between Syria and other countries in order to be able to overcome this situation.
We actually do see that in the near future, because the people in Syria do need our help very much and as soon as possible as well. I want to thank you very much, Dr. Jamal Joaquin, author, academic, and managing editor of the Contemporary Arab Affairs Journal, for joining us to talk about this crucial matter. Now, ladies and gents, please stay tuned, because next we will be talking about a new way that Israel has came up with for ethnic cleansing in Palestine.
This is Midstream, and here is IRIB English Radio. Dear listeners, in this weekly program, Marwa Osman discusses two important issues related to West Asia region with two political analysts. Midstream is with you every Friday on IRIB English Radio.
The Israeli Knesset approved a new racist law to revoke citizenship and residency from Palestinian prisoners who carried out heroic operations against the occupation's army and its settlers who reside in the Palestinian territories of 1948 and occupied Al-Quds. Now, the law provides for the deportation of these prisoners from their hometowns immediately upon the end of their sentence to areas supposedly controlled by the Palestinian Authority. Let's see more details about this in this following report.
The Israeli Knesset has passed a law making it easier for authorities to revoke citizenship and residency from Palestinians imprisoned who carried out heroic operations against the occupation army and its settlers over what Israel designates as, quote, acts of terror, unquote. The final reading of the bill, which for the first time stipulates the deportation of Palestinians to the occupied territories, was passed last Wednesday afternoon by a vast majority of Knesset, with 94 votes in support and just 10 against. This new racist law provides for the deportation of these prisoners from their hometowns immediately upon the end of their sentence to areas controlled by the Palestinian Authority. It is noticeable in the vote on this law that it came with a broad Israeli consensus among members of the government coalition and the Israeli opposition at the same time, and a dangerous indication of the dimensions of this law on the Palestinians in the occupied territories, as well as the unified Israeli position in targeting the Palestinian man, his identity, and his land. The danger of the timing of the law's adoption is that it came in an Israeli political environment that is witnessing disagreements and an escalation of the state of political tensions, conflicts, and real divisions, which reads that the Israeli occupation, when it comes to the Palestinians, they unite immediately. The targeting of this law goes beyond the issue of targeting the prisoners who carried out operations against the army of the occupation and its settlers. Rather, it is the beginning of a blatant and broad legitimization of a forced displacement and mass expulsion of Palestinians in the occupied Palestinian territories. The implementation of this law paves the way for the withdrawal of nationality and residency to implement displacement and ethnic cleansing projects against the Palestinians, especially against the residents of Wadi Ara, which is a Palestinian village occupied since 1948, and the appropriate circumstances waiting for the passage of this decades-old project. The danger in the law is that it flouts international and humanitarian law, and the start of its application means that it will be applied retroactively against Palestinians who were previously arrested in Israeli prisons and receive salaries from the Palestinian Prisoners Affairs Authority as released prisoners as a crime, and their citizenship will be revoked and they will be forcibly displaced from their homes. The racist Israeli law is in stark contrast to international law, which prohibits the expulsion of any citizen from his homeland and country. It also forms the basis for political precautions and the excessive use of the emergency systems that the Israeli occupation entity inherited from the British Mandate, including movement restrictions, administrative detention and expulsion based on ethnicity and Palestinian nationality.
New ways by Israel to ethnically cleanse the Palestinian state and nation. With us to discuss this issue from the occupied Al-Quds is Dr. Mohammad Halassi, academic and researcher in Zionist Israeli affairs. I want to thank you, Dr. Halassi, for being with us now. The seriousness of the timing of the adoption of the Israeli law requiring the withdrawal of citizenship and residency from Palestinian prisoners who carried out these heroic operations, it comes at a political moment in Israel where there is real division inside of the Israeli entity. So they fight over everything, but unanimously vote for expelling more native Palestinians from their lands. But why now, and what might be the repercussions of such a law?
This Israeli behavior is not limited to this decision taken by the Knesset of the occupation. Rather, Israel practiced such an act previously and in an effort by this government to implement its subjugation agenda. This is settler colonialism that did not come to coexist with the Palestinians. On the contrary, it came to replace it. In addition to the machine of oppression and force exercised by the armored vehicles and tanks, it also seeks, through the legislation it enacts, to expel the Palestinians. This law is in the service of the colonial system. When it comes to the Palestinians, the laws set by the occupation's Knesset comes to serve this colonial agenda, which ultimately aims to empty the Palestinian land of its inhabitants and replace them with the Zionist settlers. This comes, as you kindly pointed out, in light of the conditions of division experienced by Israeli society. However, this society, which shows signs of division and disintegration, comes together and unites completely from their far right to their far left when matters relate to the Palestinian rights. The Zionist left, which formed previous governments, has always watched the actions of the right towards the Palestinians and has never said a word. Now, when the Zionist far-right's fire bounces back internally on Israeli society, you see them demonstrating and shouting loudly to stop the far-right's advance and impose their internal agenda on the Israeli society. Yet, when it comes to the Palestinians, you see them unite and agree. When it comes to the Palestinians, they are one voice and one unit. This law comes to confirm the racism of this Israeli society and its unity to exclude the Palestinians. There is no difference in this society between its left, its center, and its far right. This law will inevitably backfire on the Israelis. The Israelis believe that imposing the logic of force and coercion on the Palestinians will bring security to its society. But experiences have shown that the more the Israeli coerce and penetrate with arrogance the Palestinian society, the more the Palestinians adhere to their rights, and the more these actions backfire on the Israelis, who will pay the price for their racism. We saw how the Palestinian society, with the natural reactions of its members, inflicted human losses on the Israeli society, causing it to lose security from a government that claimed that it was coming to impose security to protect the Israeli society.
Dr. Mohammed, the goal behind the law goes beyond the issue of targeting only the Palestinian prisoners. We all know how the Zionist entity thinks and the occupation thinks. Rather, it is just the beginning of a blatant and broad legitimization of forced displacement and ethnic cleansing of the Palestinian people in the occupied territories. That is basically the definition of what ethnic cleansing is. But who's to stop Israel from doing this? Let's say they did begin doing this. What can stop Israel from pursuing this?
Before this government, there were no Israeli governments that carried roses and brought peaceful stances towards the Palestinian people. On the contrary, all the governments that preceded this one were right-wing. We have experienced Sharon's government with his policy of breaking the bones of the Palestinians. We have seen many Israeli political leaders who left, their parties ended, their slogans ended, but Palestine remained, and the Palestinian people remained. Who stood and who will continue to stand in the face of these arrogant racist calls? Israel's problem is that it becomes blind in front of the issue of Palestinian national rights. It believes that this people has no history and that it had no national political entity. Israel wants to deal with Palestinians as mere human groups that can only have regular daily life demands, and does not want to recognize the right of this Palestinian people to their freedom and independence. As long as it deals with the Palestinians from a security angle, and as long as it views the Palestinians as a security threat, then the Israeli society will be enlightened in paying the bill for this blindness and disregard for the rights of an entire people. Israel is a manipulator who believes that the balance of power and the logic of force transcends its large military system and transcends the coverage it gets, unfortunately, from some Arab regimes. Israel is under the cover of the United States of America and international institutions, so it believes that the Palestinians can be broken. This is an issue that has always been shattered on the rock of the steadfastness of the Palestinians. This law will fall. The Palestinian prisoners and the Palestinian people will overthrow it with their steadfastness and their continued struggle, just as all previous racist laws have fallen. In this matter, we do not count on international bodies or international institutions. We count on the will of the Palestinian people.
Dr. Mohammed, we believe in the resistance of the Palestinian people and their right for a full-armed resistance against this occupation and its aggression and its blatant ethnic cleansing against the people of Palestine. I want to thank you very much from Occupied Al-Quds, Dr. Mohammed Hellasi, academic and researcher in Zionist Israeli Affairs, for joining us to talk about this pressing matter. Dear ladies and gents, thank you very much. We will see you again next week with more from the Mideast Stream.
A diverse range of programs. Youth. Spirituality. Culture, Eastern Tales, Roundtable Discussions, Politics. All produced by IRIB English Radio.
Limelight. European Union ministers have recently sought ways to curb immigration and sending away more people from Europe's borders. We have taken a look at the world media website's coverage of this issue. Please stay with us. Russia Today, RT, has covered this story and tells us more. Countries that refuse to accept their nationals back after they are turned away from the European Union will face visa restrictions, the European Union's interior ministers warned this week. They urged the European Commission to take action as illegal immigration to the EU reached its highest level since 2016. Support for restricting the number of visas granted to non-cooperative nations is strong among European Union member states, according to Swedish Minister for Migration Maria Malmer Stenergard. She claimed after a meeting of interior ministers on Thursday, 26th of January. The Swedish minister said, we see irregular arrivals increasing. Returning those who are denied asylum to Europe is a very important issue, Stenegaard added. The current level of returned migrants is not acceptable. Just 21% of the 340,000 illegal immigrants refused asylum in 2021 were returned to their countries of origin, according to Eurostat data referenced in the meeting. If the political and diplomatic efforts to improve cooperation with third countries do not produce the expected results, the member states call on the European Commission to come back with proposals on visa restrictions, the Swedish minister continued. European Commission President Ursula von der Leyen agreed that there is a need to intensify the return of illegal migrants, calling for a pilot project that would bounce failed asylum seekers back from the bloc's external borders with immediate returns. The European Union should agree on a list of safe countries where returns are unlikely to put migrants at risk, Ursula von der Leyen suggested, also recommending agreements with nations including Bangladesh, Egypt, Pakistan, Morocco, Tunisia, and Nigeria in order to prevent departures in the first place and improve returns where necessary. While the European Union previously agreed to restrict visas to countries they considered uncooperative on accepting returned nationals, the only country thus punished so far has been Gambia, whose citizens can no longer obtain multiple entry visas to the European Union and must wait longer for those papers. The European Commission has proposed similar penalties for Iraq, Senegal, and Bangladesh, but disagreements among European member countries have so far prevented agreement on whether or how to punish anyone else, according to the Reuters news agency. EU countries recorded over 330,000 illegal entry attempts last year, border control agency Frontex reported, the most since 2016, and a figure that does not include legal asylum applicants or Ukrainian refugees trying to enter Europe. More than 80% of these were adult men. The website of Arab News has also covered this story and tells us more. While European countries struggle to contain the violence perpetrated by anti-immigrant criminals, including anti-Muslim groups, and deal with the root causes of their violence, little is done to contain their hate speech or Islamophobia. While the overwhelming majority of Europeans reject their violent tactics, their rhetoric is moving from the fringes to the mainstream. Rantings against Islam are gradually becoming common in political campaigns and everyday discourse. This process threatens to normalize hate speech, especially Islamophobia, in the many parts of Europe. Confusing incitement with freedom of speech has made it difficult to address this growing threat. However, while freedom of expression is a universal value enshrined in the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, international agreements have attached duties associated with its exercise. The International Covenant on Civil and Political Rights, the main human rights instrument adhered to by most countries, seeks to address that balance. While it holds that everyone shall have the right to freedom of expression, it adds that the exercise of such a right carries with it special duties and special responsibilities. It may therefore be subject to certain restrictions, including for the protection of national security, or of public order, or of public health, or morals. Many countries have included such safeguards in their national laws. While opposition to illegal migration or excessive Legal migration is normal and falls within freedom of speech and legitimate political discourse. Desecrating the Holy Quran denigrates the faith of about 2 billion people around the world who have nothing to do with these local issues. In the case of Sweden, it has also inflamed ethnic animosities within the country and damaged its reputation and the exercise of its foreign policy, threatening its key security interests. The timing of Saturday's incident in Stockholm, Sweden is curious when taking into consideration the geopolitical dimensions such as the war in Ukraine, the changing nature of Sweden's relationship with NATO, and the talks with Turkey on that subject. Such timing raises a question about outside influence on Sweden's Islamophobes and possible foreign manipulation. Christensen condemned the burning of the Holy Quran in Stockholm as deeply disrespectful. He tweeted on Saturday, "Freedom of expression is a fundamental part of democracy, but what is legal is not necessarily appropriate. Burning books that are holy to many is a deeply disrespectful act." He expressed sympathy for all Muslims who are offended by what has happened in Stockholm today. Muslim countries and others expressed outrage at the incident, indicating a universal rejection of the desecration of the Holy Quran as a form of protest or political expression. Muslim governments expressed astonishment that the Swedish authorities had allowed it to take place, stressing that freedom of expression must be exercised in a responsible manner. Hundreds of protests and demonstrations have been held worldwide since the incident in Stockholm. Hate groups such as the Patriotic Europeans Against the Islamization of the Occident, known as Pegida, have done similar things and agitated against Islam and Muslims in other European countries, including burning a copy of the Holy Quran in Amsterdam in the Netherlands on Tuesday. Since Pegida was founded in Dresden, Germany in 2014, its extremist views have crept into mainstream political discourse in Europe, and the far right has made significant political gains in several European countries, including Sweden. Pegida and similar groups have repeatedly incited against Muslims, stoking irrational fears of being overrun by immigrants, especially Muslims. At times, they use the Holy Quran's burning as a lightning rod and a tool to attract attention, to rally support, to recruit new followers, and to incite further violence.
Defense of Iranian combatants.
A senior Iranian lawmaker has said,
contrary to Washington's claims, America's
President Raisi has emphasized that
U.S. sanctions have failed to extract concessions from Tehran.
Iran Today.
Shipping is one of the world's greatest and oldest industries with a long-standing history dating back thousands of years. As one of the oldest options for freight transportation, it's also one of the most available since oceans and waterways cover most of our planet. In fact, more than 90% of the goods transported in the world are carried by the international shipping industry. Competitive lower prices, higher security, convenient transport, and reliable delivery are some of the benefits that shipping companies can offer to their customers. Along these lines, maritime trade, shipping, and shipbuilding have been practiced by the Iranians since ancient times. Accordingly, Iran has a significant strategic position in West Asia region today due to its connection to Indian Ocean through the Persian Gulf and the Sea of Oman. After the Gulf of Mexico and the Hudson Bay, the Persian Gulf is the third biggest gulf in the world. It covers a vast area starting from the Arvand Rud Delta in the most southwestern corner of Iran to the Strait of Hormuz, which links it with the Sea of Oman and the marginal parts of the Indian Ocean.
Aside from Iran's southern shores that also include the Makran coastal strip in Balochistan, the Caspian Sea, that is the world's largest lake, is also located in northern Iran, which gives the country a considerable amount of additional sea transport with its littoral states. The Caspian Sea is bounded by Russia, Azerbaijan, Turkmenistan, and Kazakhstan. Both Iran and Russia have several active ports in the northern and southern parts of the Caspian Sea. This region carries a significant importance in terms of energy resources and up-and-coming global trade routes. To take a look at Iran as a transportational hub, please stay with us on this edition of Iran Today.
At present, Tehran appears to be fully focused on what is called the Look East policy, pursuing a slew of trade and energy agreements with Russia, China, and Central Asian nations in the context of the Shanghai Cooperation Organization that is making Iran its ninth member. Moreover, a concerted effort has been underway to facilitate trade with the whole Eurasian territory by the Islamic Republic. In that regard, China and Iran are both close to gaining membership in the Eurasian Economic Union, which will make free trade across Russia, Belarus, Kazakhstan, Kyrgyzstan, and Armenia possible. Another institution that links economies in the region and beyond is the BRICS group. Initially made up of Brazil, Russia, India, and China, it now also includes South Africa and is poised to expand further by including Iran and others. As part of these recent developments, Iran and Russia are building a new transcontinental trade route stretching from the eastern edge of Europe in Black Sea to the Indian Ocean, a 3,000-kilometer passage that's beyond the reach of any foreign intervention.
The fact is that our economy is tied to the sea, so our development and our economy must be sea-oriented. Why? Because more than 95% of our trades pass through seas, and in some export items, we have to admit that 100% of the goods are transferred via ship and vessels. For example, in the field of oil and its derivatives, i.e. petrochemicals. Therefore, in such a situation, it's necessary to gain and strengthen our maritime capacities and capabilities with vessels that carry Iranian flag.
The two countries are spending billions of dollars to speed up delivery of cargoes along rivers and railways linked by the Caspian Sea. Ship tracking data compiled by some media outlets show dozens of Russian and Iranian vessels are already plying the route.
The best type of transportation in the world is sea transportation for two reasons. One is that a large volume of goods is moved with a container called a ship. For example, we now have ships that can carry 25,000 containers. Its simple meaning is that it can carry the load of 25,000 trucks. The second reason is that it shortens the path. Why was the Suez or the Panama Canal built? Because the countries are close to each other through waterways. These two factors lead to the reduction of shipping costs. Today, 80% of goods in the world are transported by ship.
It's an example of how great power competition is rapidly reshaping trade networks in a world economy. Russia and Iran are turning toward each other, and they're both looking eastward too. The goal is to build new commercial links with the giant and fast-growing economies of Asia. The emerging trade corridor would allow Russia and Iran to shave thousands of kilometers off existing routes. Starting from the Sea of Azov, river, sea, and rail networks extend to Iranian hubs on the Caspian Sea and ultimately to the Indian Ocean. Experts estimate that Russia and Iran are investing as much as $25 billion in this corridor, helping to facilitate the flow of goods to global markets.
Beyond the self-interested U.S.-West bloc twisted perceptions, there are compelling economic reasons for the new transit route. Ships sailing the Don and Volga River traditionally traded energy and agricultural commodities. Iran is the third largest importer of Russian grain, but the range is set to widen. The two countries have announced a raft of new business deals covering goods including turbines, polymers, medical supplies, and automotive parts. Russia also supplies nuclear fuel and components for Iran's reactor in Bushehr.
Iran's strategic location in the Middle East makes it an ideal spot for freight transit. It can become a transit hub as it owns, on the one hand, access to the Far East, and on the other, to the Commonwealth of Independent States, Europe, and Africa.
The problem here is that, yes, it is very important that you have the talent for work, or that your country has the potential for something, but it is more important to create a platform to use that potential. Our geographical position is unique, but it is more important to provide the tool and to create the necessary infrastructure to exploit these geographical advantages. As a simple example, I must say that today about 2 million containers are moved in our ports, but in the port of Jebel Ali, in front of us in Dubai, it has created 10 times more capacity to store containers. Well, our position is better than Jebel Ali, but why has Dubai developed the capacity of its port more than us? Because it intends to develop infrastructure, both hardware infrastructure and software infrastructure.
It is worth mentioning that from the four railroad routes defined for global transit, three pass through Iran. The first route connects Western Europe to Russia, Kazakhstan, and China. The second goes through Europe to Turkey, Iran, South Asia, Southern China, and Southeast Asia. The third connects Europe to China via Iran and Central Asia, and the fourth passes through Northern Europe to Russia, to Central Asia, and the Persian Gulf.
By nature, our neighboring countries, like us, are moving in the direction of using their own advantages. They have activities in the area of transit, and in the last 10 years, their activities have grown well. It means a competition has been created between our country and the neighboring countries. For example, look at the country of Iraq. Since 10 years ago, this country has been pursuing the development of its Grand Fav port with a nominal capacity of about 100 million tons. It is expected that with the opening of this port and the development plan that Turkey is considering now for investing in Iraq and connecting rail lines, a certain amount of transit discussion in our country will come under the spotlight. Pakistan, too, with the investment of several tens of billions of dollars that China has made in Gwadar port, this port is not more than a few hundred kilometers away from our Chabahar port, and it can be a rival for the transfer of goods from Central Asian countries through Afghanistan and Pakistan.
Presently, Iran benefits from marine, air, road, and rail transportation systems. Iran's Ministry of Roads and Urban Development has set as part of the country's 6-5-year development plan an ambitious aim, according to which revenues from freight transit should exceed those from oil.
Our country potentially has many advantages in terms of its geographical and geopolitical location. 5,800 kilometers of coastline in the north and south of the country, the benefit of developed ports, 20 commercial ports with a capacity of about 270 million tons of transactions and unloading and loading volumes, educated workforce, and also having a suitable fleet level for marine transportation and the road and rail transport fleet is the capacities of our country. Let's not also forget that Iran is neighbored with landlocked countries or countries like Tajikistan and Central Asian countries, and being in the international corridors that countries use for import and export, these potentials and advantages are unparalleled.
Meanwhile, China, based on figures released by the Statistical Office of the European Union, is the biggest exporter of goods to the EU, followed by the US and Russia. If China's exports transited through Iran, it can significantly help Tehran fulfill its goals in the transportation sector. But why would China choose to carry out its transit project through Iran? Iran is a cheaper transit route compared to the existing routes. China has common borders with the former Soviet Union and access to the European market. Yet large-scale shipping of goods would be much cheaper via maritime routes, and this is what Iran can provide through its safe routes and borders. Of course, exporters look for the shortest, quickest, cheapest, and easiest routes of transportation, and experts believe that Iran needs to measure up to these international trade demands. They believe that in order to be able to fully exploit these propitious opportunities, the government needs to take several measures and reconsider some transit rules and regulations.
Countries are developing their own transportation routes based on their own needs. And there are two things that are influential in the transportation field: transit time and transit cost. How can these two factors be improved in our country? This requires infrastructure measures. We have to expand our logistic facilities. Our ports have a lot of capacity. We have to develop our rail system accordingly. Chabahar Port, as our only ocean port, is not yet connected to the national rail network. Or our ports in the north and the Caspian port are not yet fully connected to Azerbaijan and Astara rail lines. If we manage to develop these missing links, in the long term, our transit costs will be much lower and more competitive, and the desire of countries to use and pass through our ports will increase.
This is Iran Today. Iran Today is broadcast every week on Fridays and Saturdays. The series analyzes major political, economic, cultural, and social events concerning Iran. So don't miss the opportunity to listen to Iran Today on IRIB English Radio.
There's plenty more right after a quick diversion into world media.
Here's how it looks on the page. Financial Tribune reads, Iran-Venezuela direct shipping line to reinforce trade ties. Iran's embassy in Caracas has announced via Twitter that a direct shipping line has been established between Iran and Venezuela, with a ship set to depart every 3 months. The aim is to support trade and merchants of both countries, with the first ship having already departed for Venezuela recently. Iran has reportedly sent the first shipment on Golsan ship to Venezuela in November. The two countries signed a 20-year cooperation roadmap during a state visit by Venezuelan President Nicolas Maduro to Tehran in mid-June 2022, seeking to boost bilateral ties as they both face U.S. sanctions. Both Iran and Venezuela are heavily sanctioned by the United States, and this has brought them closer. Iran regularly sends oil to crisis-stricken Venezuela and has also loaded Venezuelan oil for sale abroad. According to Financial Times, Iran's Ghost Fleet switches into Russian oil. Tankers in Iran's Ghost Fleet have switched to carrying Russian oil since Western curbs on Moscow intensified in December as the Kremlin turned to sanctions-busting techniques pioneered by Tehran. At least 16 vessels that form part of the Ghost Network that allowed Iran to breach U.S. sanctions have begun to ship Russian crude oil over the past 2 months, according to Financial Times research. Before the surge, just 9 vessels had switched onto the Russian route during the 9 months since the start of the war in February last year. So-called ghost ships are vessels that disguise their ownership and movements in order to facilitate breaches of sanctions. Networks of ghost ships enable the trade in Iranian and Venezuelan oil. Iran has been able to maintain or even increase its crude exports in recent months. Tehran, which cooperates on oil policy with Moscow through the OPEC Plus group, has emerged as a key backer for Russian President Vladimir Putin's invasion of Ukraine. Tehran Times says China ready to partake in Iran's maritime projects. Considering the positive negotiations between the two sides during the recent visit of President Ebrahim Raisi to China, the Chinese have expressed readiness to participate in all Iranian marine projects, head of the Supreme Council of Marine Industries Secretariat Saeed Jafari said on Monday. Considering that China is one of the world's largest maritime producers and has large and capable companies in this field, during the recent trip we had negotiations with one of these companies and good agreements were achieved, Jafari said. He noted that the main focus of the discussions between the two sides has been on technology transfer for manufacturing large-scale vessels. Heading a high-ranking delegation, Iran's President Ebrahim Raisi was on a three-day visit to China starting February 14th. During President Raisi's visit to China, Tehran and Beijing signed a number of bilateral cooperation documents in the fields of agriculture, trade, tourism, environmental protection, health, disaster relief, culture, and sports. In its latest maritime report dubbed Review of Maritime Transport 2021, UNCTAD, which is an intergovernmental organization within the United Nations Secretariat that promotes the interests of developing countries in world trade, has put Iran in the 22nd place among the countries with the largest shipping fleet based on deadweight tonnage. UNCTAD has put the total number of the world's commercial ships, including tankers, container ships, and bulk carriers, at the end of 2021 at 99,800. The total capacity of the mentioned ships is estimated at 2,134,640,000 tons in 2021, which has increased by 3% over the previous year. In 2020, the cargo capacity of the world shipping fleet was estimated at 2,071,638,000 tons. Based on the report, the capacity of Iran's shipping fleet is more than many industrialized countries such as France, Italy, Canada, and the Netherlands. Iran's ranking has not changed in 2021 compared to the previous year. The Islamic Republic currently has 246 vessels carrying the national flag and 8 foreign flag vessels with a total capacity of 19,251,146 tons. The total capacity of the Iranian shipping fleet has increased by 5.5% in 2021, according to the said report.
We are connected to both the sea and the ocean. What advantage does this ocean have over the sea? Almost every 10 years, draft of ships increases by 1 meter. Port Sadar in the ocean are expensive to build. But in Chabahar or the Makran coast, we need less dredging in order to reach a draft of 20 to 25 meters. Therefore, we are not just a maritime country. We are also an ocean country. That is, if one day all our ports have problems and we only build ports on Makran coast, our cost in terms of sea transportation will be lower. This issue benefits the national economy, both for import and export. Therefore, corridors from west to east and from north to south are in the country's interest due to the geographical location of Iran to pass through our country.
As Iran's flag carrier, the Islamic Republic of Iran Shipping Lines has recorded its highest annual income in the previous Iranian calendar year that ended on March 20th, despite the pandemic and the U.S. sanctions, earning $1.5 billion. According to IRISL officials, although the Iranian shipping fleet has been facing serious restrictions for accessing major ports around the world due to the COVID-19 pandemic and also the U.S. sanctions over the past 2 years, great achievements have been made in its operations, emphasizing the important role of the IRISL in maintaining and prosperity of the country's economy.
Facing a new regime of sanctions in 2018, which led European reinsurers refusing to give insurance to firms importing Iranian oil, Iran provided ships as well as insurance cover to continue exporting crude oil to its customers. It appears that Iranians have often been one step ahead of the U.S. in these matters. For many years, the Islamic Republic has frustrated American attempts to isolate it and starve its economy, even if they had to construct a parallel underground universe that Iranian entities used to avoid international controls when necessary and to conduct business abroad. This explains how Iran won the so-called maximum pressure campaign, according to a top official in the U.S. government.
According to some studies done by an international institution, in the face of obstacles and sanctions restrictions imposed on Iran, Iran's large maritime transport fleet became a significant lever in neutralizing the pressure from the American sanctions. In light of that, in 2021, 8 ships were added to Iran's commercial fleet. In 2022, this quantity grew another 1%, and Iran's cargo capacity reached 19,441,000 tons.
The sea is the most important blessing that God has given us. Imagine if we didn't have a sea. What would the sanctions do to us?
If a truck wants to deliver goods to China or Europe by land, it has to pass through dozens of countries, get dozens of traffic permits, dozens of visas, and pass through dozens of borders. Even airplanes are like that. When a plane wants to go from one point to another, it has to cross the skies of several countries, and for this, it has to get permission. And about the sea, fortunately, this is not the case.
Meanwhile, considering Iran's special geographical position in the region and its shared borders with several coastal countries, both in the south and north, shipbuilding has always been among the major industries strongly entangled with the country's economy. In 1973, Iran's shipbuilding and offshore industries complex, Izo-Eco, was established as the largest shipbuilding complex in West Asia.
At first, small-sized vessels, which were considered under 2,000 tons, started to be produced decentralized in the north and south of the country. In the 1990s, based on the grand policies of the country, factories that could be a turning point in the production of ocean-going vessels began to operate. The military industry of shipbuilding also became the cause. Naturally, due to the defense requirements and the increase in the country's capabilities, military factories were much more advanced than civilian factories, and fortunately, with the combination of science and experience of the Ministry of Defense, the opportunity was created to transfer technology from the military system to the commercial system, which accelerated growth and progress in the country's shipbuilding industry.
At the initial stage, the complex was established with the aim of creating facilities to repair small and medium-sized vessels. Later, the complex's equipment and facilities were developed for the construction and repair of larger tankers.
The science that has been institutionalized in Iran and localized by the experts of this land has made it possible to build any type of ship in Iran. Naturally, there are problems that create obstacles, and this obstacle targets technical and economic bottlenecks. We have many examples of the construction of complex ships in the military system, which were produced by the capable hands of Iranian engineers. But we have to accept the fact that because of the sanctions, we are faced with numerous shortages in this area.
In July 2019, Izo-Eco successfully finished the overhaul operation of a supertanker for the first time inside the country. Iranian technicians managed to repair the oil supertanker Dor. Following the successful overhaul of Dor, major domestic ship owners like the National Iranian Tanker Company and the Islamic Republic of Iran shipping lines started referring a major part of their overhaul operations to local yards in order to reduce the costs and also to encourage domestic yards to expand their work.
For vessels below 5,000 tons, we have the ability to produce more than 90% of the equipment inside the country, but for vessels above 5,000 tons, which are called conventional vessels, almost 50% of the parts have to be supplied from abroad. Given the fact that in the construction of ships, all the parts and equipment are unique to each ship itself, in the conditions of sanctions, it's a bit difficult to provide them. But at the same time, it has been managed so far.
Following the country's two major shipbuilders, new private companies have also entered the field over the past few years, making the industry expand its roots both inside the country and at the global level. Accordingly, in addition to repairing international vessels, Iranian shipbuilding companies have also successfully built three large oil tankers ordered by Venezuela.
You can see the pinnacle of shipbuilding artistry and engineering in these two Iranian-made oil tankers, that is Aframax 1 and 2. In this size and category, more than seven ships have been built in the past 20 years, excluding military ships that use very high and complex technologies. The construction of these two ships was subject to the same components that I mentioned to you when they were launched. They obtained international permits. We have 11 sets of ship ratings which apply the strictest standards required to produce a ship.
The shipbuilding industry does not have a high profit margin like some other industries, and usually the countries are only successful in this field that have all the upstream and downstream industries and the supply chain in some way. We in our country are now giving orders to shipbuilding companies. For example, the Islamic Republic of Iran Shipping Line Group, IRISL, has signed four contracts with Sadra Shipbuilding Company this year for the production of four ships, two of which are roll-on-roll-off vessels, and the other two are 3,500 tons vessels. I believe that if the government shows enough support to this industry, this potential could be used in a better way, especially if we can attract foreign investment in this area.
In September 2022, Venezuelan President Nicolas Maduro announced receiving the third ship with the most advanced engineering technology in the world from Iran to local media.
That's all for today. Thank you from the whole team. Do tune in same time next week and each week after. Don't forget to leave your comments and topic requests. Till next time, take care.
Your option, our task.